Seated, please. Court is now ready to hear argument in 090377, Aaron Glenn Haygood versus Margarita Garza de Escobedo.
May it please the court, Mr. Kelly will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Peter Kelly here on behalf of the underlying plaintiff, Aaron Haygood. The issue today before this court is a narrow question of statutory interpretation. And like most questions of statutory interpretation, it can be resolved by looking at the plain language of the statute.
Mr. Kelly, do you agree that if a tortfeasor injures an individual, then that tortfeasor is required to make that individual whole?
That is one of the underlying premises of tort law going back thousands of years.
What does that mean to you?
What does that mean is that the plaintiff, the injured party, the claimant, should be made whole for the damages that he has suffered at the hands of the tortfeasor.
So he suffered, or would that be damages he incurred?
Those would be the damages he incurred. Historically, what this court has defined as that the plaintiff is entitled to his actual damages. That's going back to 1980 in the Kish case in 1985 and the Brown case in 1980. Actual damages are those damages that are allowable at common law. And those are the damages that are suffered as a direct result of, or you know, producing cause, however you want to define it, of the defendant's act. There has to be approximate causation in the tort realm.
But if an injured party has a bill for a dollar and then is reimbursed 90 cents, shouldn't he only be made whole the difference from what he is out of pocket?
Well, this court has also held, and going back to 1972, in the Black case, which was recently referred to in the Aviles case last year, that how we determine what actual damages have been suffered is you look at what the expenses have been incurred. And as this court said, you look at incurred is defined as the obligation pursuant to the implied contract between the provider and the patient incurred in the first instance. So when a patient shows up at a hospital, there is an implied contract between the healthcare provider and the patient that the patient will be liable for all the expenses that have been charged or incurred on his behalf. Now, how that's ultimately resolved, whether it's by a cash payment, whether it's a payment by the patient itself, or a payment by an insurance company, or some sort of write-off reduction in the fees, doesn't ultimately matter. What we have is, at the first instance, the incurrence of that obligation. And that is what historically at common law and statutorily has been defined as reasonable and necessary damages.
Why doesn't it matter? I mean, if we're going to make the plaintiff or the injured party whole, it seems like there's a windfall if there's a bill for a dollar and the party's only responsible for 10 cents and he gets reimbursed the entire dollar.
That's not necessarily a windfall because you have to look at how the reduction occurred. If you look at the collateral source rule, which rewards the plaintiffs for his foresight in having insurance, if that reduction occurs because of the plaintiff's foresight, then it's not a windfall to him. He's been paying his insurance premiums for years. He's taken a lower paying job so he can have insurance coverage through his employer. All of these things, it's the status of the patient or the claimant at the time of the injury, at the time the services are rendered.
Does it matter if it's that type of insurance policy that's been secured or if it's a Medicare benefit that the injured party receives?
I don't think ultimately it does because you still have the implied contract. The implied contract entered into at the time of the services are rendered between the health care provider. And as this court said in Black in 1972, and the statutes haven't changed since then, that there is that is incurred at the time, no matter who pays it.
What about Linstetter that just came out last year in 2007, where the plaintiff sought the full medical charges billed by the hospital rather than the reduced amount paid by the carrier, and we stated that we agree that a full recovery of medical expenses would amount to a windfall, and then in a footnote we stated that that rule has since been codified, referring to 41.0105. What's your response to that?
Well, in that footnote, it refers to 410105. But you said the rule has been codified. The rule you're referring to is Allstate versus Fort. Now, what's curious about Allstate versus Fort is that it was a standing case, whether they were standing to pursue these medical charges for which they would not be liable. Well, Allstate versus Forth, and it's a key thing that's often overlooked, in those cases, in that case, the statute of limitations had already passed.
Mm-hmm.
There never could be a legal obligation to pay for those charges. So what Allstate and Forth was, it's a standing case. You can't sue to recover something that you don't have an underlying right to recover. Now, as we all know, and this goes back to first-year contract law and statutes of limitation. Just because the limitation has passed does not mean the debt is discharged. The obligation is still existing. The other thing that Forth doesn't address and Lindstedter doesn't address is we have sort of a moving target a lot of times in terms of whether things are written off. And it happens all the time that patient gets a letter from the healthcare provider that says zero. Well, they can change their mind. That's not a binding contract or a formal waiver or an accord and satisfaction. In Forth, you had a different creature because there was no further legal right to recover. And so what's happened is it's sort of this narrow class of obligations discussed in Allstate versus Forth has has somehow grown to include all obligations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a false line of authority for the court to be relying on Forth and saying that was codified in 41.0105.
Mm-hmm.
Is this issue really any different from the court's decision in the Avalis case involving attorney's fees when they're incurred?
Well, I think this particular issue right now that we have right now is actually two separate issues. One is, does paid incurred create a new measure of damages, replacing hundreds of years of jurisprudence and the statutory prescriptions in 18.001? Is there a new measure of damages? And that goes through the preservation, whether a no evidence challenge will suffice here. And secondly, what is the definition of incurred? And I think incurred has been defined in 1972 in Black and in Aviles and in Gomez. And when we first started looking at this issue and found Black, it hadn't been cited in years, but then it's been cited twice in the past year by this very court. And if incurred means incurred in the first instance, the obligation to pay is incurred no matter who pays it. You recall in Aviles, the insurance company paid it. It should mean the same thing here.
What is the modifier actually, though, before the word incurred? What does that do to your argument? Or what should we do with the word actually?
This is almost like, it's reminding me of Lewis Carroll. If it's incurred shall mean actually incurred. But when you think about it, if it's not actually incurred, then it hasn't been incurred in the first instance. And part of this is sort of you have to follow the legislative process, track through the various changes of the statute. Initially, it was incurred shall mean actually paid. Then later, incurred got stuck in after actually paid. So, and you sort of have to read it as an expansion of what incurred is. If originally incurred was just actually paid, it's actually now actually paid and incurred. So I don't think there's any fundamental difference between incurred and actually incurred. I mean, it's sort of an unfortunate use of a colloquial intensifier that doesn't really have any legal meaning.
Okay,
so you don't think it matters whether you're in 41.0105 actually modifies paid or whether it modifies both paid and incurred?
It's unclear from the legislative history whether it modifies both. Like I said, it started off as actually paid, which sort of implied some sort of cash payment, and now you have incurred tacked onto it. And there are two ways grammatically to read it, as in actually paid or incurred. But then you have incurred shall be incurred, which seems a little bit redundant. But it's redundant anyway. I don't think actually means anything, has a specific legal meaning in this particular context.
What role does the jury really play in these? If post-verdict, the trial court is supposed to look at liens paid and paid off and the money that actually changes hands. It just seems to me that, I mean, the jury's not told right about the amounts that are paid by Medicare or whether liens have been waived or not, right? They're just asked to determine the amount of medical expenses.
Well, not just the amount of medical expenses. It's not a rubber stamp by the jury. they are supposed to make the determination of what is reasonable and necessary. And historically, you know, throughout the practice of law, you have, anytime you see reasonable, determining what a reasonable man is, that's a question for the jury to determine. So they're determining what is the reasonable and necessary medical expenses. After they've determined the reasonable and necessary medical expenses and returned their verdict, awarded the damages, the court then decides what's going to be recovered. And recovery comes in post-verdict. And it is a legal determination made by the court, because if you go back to Black, when you're talking about the implied contract between the healthcare provider and the recipient and the patient, what the court is doing at that point is interpreting the implied contract, looking at the medical bills and whatever purported write-offs there are or other payments. So what they're doing is interpreting the implied contract and applying it to the written documents it has. It's not a function for the jury to do. The court is making the legal determination. So the jury determines what juries always determine, what is reasonable in terms of the medical expenses. The court then applies what is to be recovered by interpreting the implied contract. And that's consistent with any other limitations we have on recovery. For instance, in Chapter 32 and Chapter 33, where the settlement percentages are applied. That is done after the verdict. And Chapter 33 specifically talks about shall recover. Chapter 74 doesn't talk about recovery, but it is a limitation on liability of a $250,000 cap, and you can stack the caps. But the court applies that cap, applies that limitation after the jury has spoken. And what's interesting about that is to bootstrap that to say, well, it's not relevant evidence, or she can sustain a no evidence challenge. It's not like in a Med-Mal case, the plaintiff puts on medical expenses or evidence of economic damages and then just stops at $250,000. I mean, he can put on millions of dollars and show that he's suffered millions of dollars of damages. That doesn't mean that the evidence of the damages beyond $250,000 is irrelevant or not part of the measure of damages. The measure of damages remains reasonable and necessary, remains actual damages, which is historically recovered in common law. There is a post-verdict judicial application of the statute.
As I understand it, you differentiate between a limit on recovery and a limitation on damages, right? Can you explain that to me?
The damages that the plaintiff is entitled to, well, it's not just a limit on damages, it's a limit on the evidence of damages, what we're really looking at.
Well, there's evidence, and then there's the remedy, and then there's the damages. You seem to differentiate between the three, correct?
Well, I don't differentiate. The law more or less differentiates.
But
the plaintiff is entitled to damages. He's entitled to put on proof of his measure of damages,
right,
which for these purposes is reasonable and necessary medical expenses. The jury determines that. At the end of the day, what the claimant actually recovers, what money he actually puts in his pocket, is determined by operation of statute and other laws. So, yes, there is a difference between the damages that have been suffered, and there are lots of limitations on it. I mean, we're talking about Chapter 74 caps, contribution indemnity, Texas Tort Claim Act limitations, and all those, the jury's not informed about those.
Sure.
And it doesn't affect the quality or the admissibility of the evidence. And the statute does not talk about the quality or admissibility of evidence. The argument is made that the title...
I was going to say the title says evidence.
Well, the title says evidence, but we only look at the title if the statute is not clear. And the statute clearly says recover, and you look at the legislature's other uses of recover, for instance, in Chapter 33 and Chapter 32, we know what they're talking about.
Well, and if you look at the history, it actually looks like they were intending to take out evidence from the substance of that statute. Do you think that's relevant?
This has a very convoluted history.
Right.
Yes, initially they were talking about, it had a direct and explicit abrogation of the collateral source rule.
Exactly.
That was taken out.
Right.
And it had the title at the time. Actually, when it first started off, it was talking about recovery of medical expenses.
Right.
Then you had to add in the abrogation of the collateral source rule, and the title changed to evidence.
Right.
Then in the final version, after it finally came out of the Senate and was ultimately signed, the title had remained the same, even though the explicit abrogation of the collateral source rule had been removed.
Right.
So it's almost accidental that we have this title appended to it. Well, it is accidental. But we still have to take that as an act of the legislature, but we can look at what evidence actually is. Evidence does not necessarily mean jury evidence. In all the rules of civil procedure, you talk about evidence in the summary judgment context and in several other contexts. That's not jury evidence. And when the legislature has wanted to affect what evidence goes before the jury, for instance, in chapter in 41.011 about evidence relating to exemplary damages, it is titled evidence. It's in the title, but in the actual text, it talks about what evidence is going to go to the jury very explicitly and very clearly. So in this instance, in 41.105, we don't have that explicit rendition of what's going to be going before the jury. What you have is a stray reference in the title that says evidence. It does not say jury evidence. It does not say admissible evidence. But you do have the plain language, which refers to recover, and we know what recover means. And this is a very straightforward syllogism that the legislature used words, recover and incurred, that we actually know the meaning of by comparison to other legislative acts and to the writings of this court.
Counsel, let me just ask very briefly, and then I'll probably follow up on rebuttal. Do you believe in the statute, so I can be clear, that actually refers to incurred or not in the statutory language?
I think it has its most significant meaning in relation to paid. And sort of as an accident of grammatical construction, it does not affect the meaning of the word incurred.
That partially answers my question. Does actually reference or define or limit incurred or not?
I don't think it grammatically modifies it, but I don't think it affects the legal meaning. Because if it's not actually incurred, it hasn't been incurred to begin with.
Okay, so actually modifies paid and actually modifies incurred in the statutory language.
Yes, but I don't think it limits what's incurred because we have to look at what that would actually mean.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Kelly. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Colley will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Absent proof that past medical care expenses have been actually paid or actually incurred, evidence of the reasonable and necessary value of medical care is not legally sufficient to support a verdict. And absent proof that past medical care expenses have been actually paid or actually incurred, evidence simply of the reasonable and necessary value of medical expenses is irrelevant and inadmissible.
Now, if we agree with you, do we have to retract the Avalos case and the Gomez case?
No, Your Honor, because I don't think Avalos or Gomez addresses the specific issue in this case.
He talks about fees incurred.
Sure it does. Again, I want to get back to a point that Justice Wainwright just established. The operative term here is actually. It modifies incurred. So what we're dealing with is a statute that uses incurred once, unmodified, and then uses it again with the modifier actually. Those two must mean something different. I disagree with counsel when he says that incurred is the same thing as actually incurred, because that violates the cardinal rule of construction that we don't consider any words meaningless. We don't consider the word actually meaningless. And so to get back to your question about Avilas, Avilas dealt with the word incurred, not the phrase actually incurred. The second differentiation between the issue in this case and the issue in Avilas is what this court held in Avilas was that the defendant doctor incurred expenses that were actually paid on his behalf. It did not deal with a situation in which the third-party payor paid a certain amount to get rid of or extinguish another amount. So it doesn't, and the same issue with Black. In Black, all of the plaintiff's medical expenses were actually paid by Medicare and his carrier. There was no issue in that case of write-offs, discounts, or adjustments. Same as in Avilas. There was no issue of write-offs, discounts, or adjustments. Another way of stating that is Avilas doesn't tell us what happens when a third-party payer comes along later, pays a portion of the incurred amount, and the provider of that service forgives the rest. Avilas, neither Avilas nor Black addressed that issue.
The dissent in the court below was concerned that the interpretation by the majority failed to give meaning to the term incurred, as used, I guess, in the statute in the beginning.
In which court?
In the court below.
In this case?
Yes.
We didn't have a dissent in this case.
Sorry. Maybe look at...
You're talking about the dissent in Mills.
I am. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry. Yes. Mills versus Fletcher.
That was a plurality opinion. And the dissent in Mills is primarily a policy-based dissent, arguing that the statute as interpreted by the majority was unfair and unreasonable. My response to that is whether this statute is unfair, whether it's unreasonable, whether it's unwise, is a matter for the legislature to determine. It's not a matter for the courts to determine. The court's job is to interpret the statute as written. But to get back to the dissent in Mills, I think the dissent in Mills was incorrect in that the phraseology in this statute starts with, in addition to any other limitation under law. We know right there that they're changing the law. The legislature is not intending to maintain the status quo when they say that. Then they say the recovery of expenses incurred. That defines the universe of expenses that could potentially be incurred, that could potentially be recoverable. Then they go on to say is limited to. So right there we know that that's a signpost to what we're about to see coming up next is a limitation. Is limited to the amount actually paid or incurred. Again, actually modifies both paid and incurred.
And if it doesn't modify both, is the argument different?
Well, then if it doesn't modify both, the sentence makes no sense. Because if it doesn't modify both, then what we're reading is the recovery of expenses incurred is limited to the expenses incurred. And that doesn't really make any sense. So actually has to modify it. And actually has to change the meaning of the second use of the word incurred. Otherwise, actually can be read out of the statute and it's meaningless. And that violates the rules, the cardinal rules of statutory construction in Texas. So we know that incurred and actually incurred... You look like you want to ask a question.
I was just going to ask you. Now, one approach that has been suggested and adopted, and I think is used to a certain extent, is to admit all evidence of payments and reductions or payments at trial, and then for the determination of what's reasonable and necessary, and then send it back to the judge afterwards to adjust according to the language of the statute. Do you agree with that? Is that how you think that it should be handled?
Absolutely not. Okay. And I think it cannot, absolutely cannot be handled that way for a number of reasons.
Could you explain that, please?
Yes, I've got a number of reasons why that can't be.
Well, it's just kind of limited because I want to know how that would affect the collateral source rule if you were correct.
Okay. The first issue is under section 41.008, the statute says, in an action in which a claimant seeks recovery of damages, the trier of fact shall determine the amount of economic damages separately from other compensatory damages. That's important because it's saying that the trier of fact determines economic damages. Now, remember that the title of this statute is Evidence Relating to Amount of Economic Damages. So it is the jury that is supposed to determine the economic damages subject to the limitations set forth in section 41.0105. So it is the jury that is supposed to determine what the amount actually paid and actually incurred is.
But what's the effect of that subject to?
Part, what do you mean subject?
That under 41.0105, because they make that determination, but then, I mean, how do we get around?
Oh, I see what you mean. What do I mean by subject to?
Right.
What I mean
right.
is the jury is determining what, by virtue of 41.008, the jury determines economic damages. Mm-hmm. With respect to medical care expenses, Section 410105 defines what those economic damages are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that definition must be used to guide the jury in making their determination with respect to the recoverability of medical care expenses. So it has to be the jury that does that, not the court after the fact. Secondly, the title, as you notice, the title says evidence. And Mr. Kelly said that the only time we ever look at the title is if the statute's ambiguous. But the Code Construction Act, Section 311023, says whether or not a statute is ambiguous, we can look at the title of the statute to determine its meaning. So the title is further proof that it's to be applied in evidence. And if it's to be applied in at the evidentiary stage, as the title suggests, then by necessity it cannot be applied post-verdict. The jury's got to hear about it.
If you look at the history of that, I think the substance of that statute really did have to do with evidence, and that was taken out.
And I want to address the legislative history issue, because I don't think we even need to be consulting legislative history. This is a situation much like Entergy, where the only basis for the plaintiff's argument on that point is the deletion of words during the drafting process. And in Entergy, this court says that the deletion of words in the drafting process does not tell us what the statute means. In fact, it's the quote is from Antonin Scalia, in which he says it's always perilous to try to derive meaning from words deleted in the drafting process. And the Entergy court specifically rejected, because that was the deletion of words in the drafting process was the primary argument that the plaintiffs were making in that case, and the court flat out rejected it and said, no, we're not going to look at what words were deleted in the process, in the drafting process, and try to determine what was meant by what was actually enacted. We're going to look at what the legislature actually wrote in the law that actually passed, and not anything else.
Counsel, what about the statute's use of the word recovery? I've tried cases, as you apparently have done a lot. You know, recovery has to go through the screen of the judge before you determine what the recovery is, as opposed to the jury verdicts or the jury award. Why doesn't that have some meaning in this provision?
Well, I want to get back to the issue of a measure of damages. To me, the components or elements necessary to a recovery is the measure of damages. That's the guidepost. Juries have to be guided in terms of awarding damages by some standard or measure. This statute adds a component to the old measure of damage, which was reasonable and necessary. Now, getting to your question specifically about the word recovery, I don't think that the use of the word recovery precludes a jury finding of the economic damages. And 4108A specifically says, in an action in which a claimant seeks recovery of damages. And then it goes on to say the trier of fact shall determine the amount of economic damages. So what that means is the simple use of the word recovery does not preclude the trier of fact from considering the elements that are necessary to prove that, to establish that recovery. I also want to give an example that points out exactly why, Justice Lehrman, we can't do this post-verdict. Let's assume that a person is injured in an accident, and he receives treatment from two treaters. We'll call them Treater A and Treater B. Treater A's bills are $50,000, and Treater B's bills are $50,000. Treater A accepts $25,000 in full satisfaction of its bills through a contractual agreement with a third-party health insurer. Treater B is out of network, or for whatever reason, does not agree to reduce its bills in full satisfaction, and the plaintiff remains responsible for the entire $50,000 bill. Now, if we do as the petitioners ask us to do, let the jury hear about both sets of 50, all $100,000 worth of bills, what happens if the jury comes back with an award of $50,000? Did the jury award the $50,000 as a representation of what Treater A billed? Or did it award the $50,000 that Treater B billed? And the difference is significant. Because if the judge signed, this is what I call the danger of an incurably reversible judgment. Because if the judge signs a $50,000 judgment, that is automatically reversible under this court's teachings in Crown Life Insurance versus Castile and in Harris County versus Smith. Those cases say that if you combine invalid and valid theories of recovery or recoverable with unrecoverable damages, and we can't tell as the Supreme Court, we can't tell whether the jury awarded damages that are not recoverable, then we've got to reverse the case and we've got to remand it back for a new trial. And so in every situation in which the jury awards some amount less than the full amount of billed expenses, the trial judge isn't going to have any way of knowing what the jury did, what bills it intended to allow recovery for.
There are some cases that say that the only reason the plaintiff in your hypothetical was able to afford any of that, $50,000 or $75,000, what have you, is because they had the foresight to obtain insurance, and that it would not be reasonable or equitable to give the tortfeasor the benefit of that plaintiff's foresight, paying premiums all these years or what have you. And that seems to be at least one of the bases for permitting recovery of the entire amount in, you know, a couple states. What's your reaction to that?
Okay, well, there's a couple of points there, Your Honor. First of all, as the premise of your question suggests, that's an argument of equity and fairness. Presumably, the legislature took into account all those issues of equity and fairness and public policy when they decided to enact the statute, and they enacted it nonetheless. So I don't think we should concern ourselves with those types of issues. But getting directly to your question, what we know, well, first of all, this case is not a foresight of obtaining insurance case. This is a Medicare case. Secondly, even in those cases, we don't know. We don't have in the record what percentage of people actually had the foresight to go out and buy their insurance or what percentage of people get it through their employer or through a union or through other sources. So The premise may be faulty there, that they had the foresight to go out and buy it, and they spent premiums out of their own pocket and blah, blah, blah.
Those premiums aren't free. I mean, if you're working for an employer, they take some out of your paycheck, last I
checked. Well, absolutely, they might. But my point there is the record doesn't support an argument on that. We just don't know how much on average employers take out of paychecks and those kinds of things. But even more importantly, though, the tortfeasor's acts and omissions did not cause the plaintiff to sustain insurance premiums. By definition, they must have had that insurance before the accident. Otherwise, they wouldn't get the insurance coverage because it would be a pre-existing condition. So they were paying premiums before the accident. Whether the accident happened or not, presumably they would keep paying premiums. And they pay premiums, I think this is an important too, people pay premiums not with an eye toward a potential investment in litigation. People pay premiums to protect their families from injury and illness. And the point being is that it's not the foresight that a plaintiff had in obtaining evidence such that they could gain a windfall in a litigated matter. The incident that injures the plaintiff has nothing to do with the payment of premiums.
What's the question to the jury on the amount of medical expenses.
And I'm glad you asked that. The pattern jury charge has already changed. The State Bar Committee, the State Bar Pattern Jury Charge Committee has already put in the pattern jury charge, if there's a question about actually paid or actually incurred, that the jury charge must read medical care actually paid or incurred.
Where is reasonable and necessary?
It's not in there. And it wasn't in the prior jury charge either. But the point there is if the pattern jury charge committee believes that the jury is supposed to determine what is actually paid or incurred, then the jury must be given that evidence. They can't be simply given evidence of the full amount of reasonable and necessary charges.
Of course, the pattern jury charge is not authoritative.
Absolutely.
It doesn't bind us.
If that's absolutely right. The pattern jury charge is not law.
But if in a medical case, the plaintiff's evidence about the medical expenses don't include any expert opinion that they're reasonable or necessary, you're going to object, and you're going to win.
Absolutely.
And to be part of the proof.
It does have to be part of the proof.
So it has
to. And so my, if you'll go back to what the rule was that I announced that I think the short court should adopt, it says, absent proof that past medical care expenses have been actually paid or actually incurred, then evidence of reasonable and necessary charges is legally insufficient. Once you establish, once the plaintiff gets on the stand and says, answers the question, how much of your medical bills have been paid? X amount. How much do you still owe? Y amount. That's all you got to do.
There's been talk of windfalls this morning. You used the word windfall a few minutes ago. As you construe the statute, and your client had some good fortune, too, by striking a Medicare patient, a Medicare plaintiff, and therefore you don't have to pay the full cost of the accident. And there's good fortune, I guess, on both sides here.
Well, I don't think you could characterize my client incurring liability as a windfall. Sure, that liability may not be as much as it used to be.
But your client is not having to pay the full cost of the accident.
Absolutely. I don't think that's a windfall. Putting money in your pocket that is supposed to be earmarked for medical care expenses but will never be used for that purpose is a windfall. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Kelly. Well, the court will hear rebuttal first.
All right.
The meaning of incurred means through the writings of this court. We go back to Black, and it defined what actually incurred means. As we said, talked about earlier, the implied contract, and it's all the charges that are incurred for which the patient becomes obligated to pay. That definition was used in the legal context in the MedMal case, in the Aviles case, and in Gomez. And now as I say this, I'm trying to remember which case I'm referring to, where the attorney's testimony was not that he had been paid or that anybody had paid the $12,500 in fees. But merely, that was in Gomez.
Did you forget it?
But it was merely reasonable and necessary. And he was entitled, the defendant doctor was entitled to get that $12,500 in reasonable fees. No evidence that it was paid. No evidence that he would ever have to pay it. And that's what we have here, the determination of what is the reasonable and necessary medical expenses. And the reasonableness is, it comes into play all throughout the tort process. The duties that are ascribed are to a reasonable person. What steps would a reasonably prudent person take? What are the damages that are incurred? It's what the reasonable damages are as found by the jury. And so one example would be, say, if I bought a car from my brother, and because he loves me, he let me buy it for $100. But it's a $20,000 car. I get hit the next day. Car gets towed. Sue the person that hit me. Do I get $100 because that's just what I paid? Or do I get the reasonable value of my economic loss, of my loss, the actual damage I suffered, which was the loss of the car? So we have this reasonable overlay that the jury is supposed to determine the reasonable duties and the reasonable damages. And interpreting this statute.
That's the problem I seem to have is time passes, it's harder and harder to tell what a reasonable medical charge is. I mean, is it what the provider asks for? Is it what the service, the insurance industry says, this is all we're ever going to pay, and everybody says, well, that's right? Is it, if there were some patient choice involved, would it be some lesser number? It's very hard to tell.
But that is
like cars, for example, or real estate.
Well, this is one problem of applying market economics to healthcare. What is the actual market? We don't have market prices for these things, which is why it's more important for the jury to determine what is reasonable and necessary. And one of the amicus briefs, the one that was just filed this week by Univar, they make that point in saying, well, we don't know what a reasonable charge is. Well, that's not for the paid incurred statute. I mean, that is a reason to go to the legislature and lobby them to tinker with the definition of reasonable and necessary in 18.001. That could call for some other legislative action. It doesn't affect what's paid incurred here. I mean, we have reasonable and necessary established in the common law and established by statute. If you want to tinker with that definition, we should go back to the statute.
But it does seem, as a matter of economics, as if wrongdoers are sort of externalizing their costs of wrongdoing onto others, namely non-Medicare patients. You know, private insurance premiums go up. You know, uninsured people who have means pay more because Medicare rates are so low. Hospitals try to recoup that cost by, you know, jacking up prices on others. So there may be a benefit to a defendant for striking. I had the good fortune to strike a Medicare patient. But those costs are being externalized onto others, kind of in the system.
And almost randomly. And as you wrote in the Rankin opinion, we need to avoid actuarial uncertainty. And this does nothing but increase actuarial uncertainty. What is the cost of a defendant, say, not properly lighting a stair? Well, that's going to vary depending on whether the person who's injured from taking the misstep has private insurance or has Medicare or has some other way or is paying out of pocket. What it does is, like I said, the tort system is based on reasonability and predictability. That's what actors need to know. What are the predictable results of any particular negligence? If we introduce further actuarial uncertainty beyond simple eggshell plaintiff uncertainty, but actually where the payments are going to be coming from, it becomes even harder for social and economic actors to determine what the results of their negligence are going to be, what precautions they need to take. So, I mean, there's sort of a deeper fundamental reason that we need to be looking at this, not just what the preamble to the statute. The core is we have a statute. It's imperfectly drafted. We can tell what its meaning is, very basic interpretation. And this is where the court can apply Occam's razor, where you're supposed to take the simplest approach to get the meaning. And we can adapt the defense point of view and say that, well, the evidence that's referred to in the title, we have to interpolate a word there. Well, recovery, well, we're used differently than it's ever used in any other statute. And that actually means ultimately or further limitation. And what they're asking the court to do is completely rewrite the statute. Well, the legislature didn't mean that. They meant something else. So we're just going to go ahead and say it. But that's not what the legislature said.
Mr. Kelly, I see that your time has expired. I don't see any further questions. And so the cause is submitted. And the court will take another brief recess.